I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome to the channel, and thanks for joining us. I just spoke with Feng Ping about the new book, The Efficacious Landscape, on the authorities of painting at the Northern Song Court. This came out with Harvard University Asia Center in 2015. Now, this is a book that's really exciting in the way that it's bringing together poetry and writing about painting and paintings of various forms in various kinds of places made for various kinds of uses by various kinds of people to tell a story about imaging and painting, landscape painting, ink painting in particular, as a form of currency, as a form of exchange, as a form of political commentary, and as a form of decoration, and much, much more at the Northern Song Court. So the two parts of the book take us through, respectively, the ways that and the reasons that the court decided to support and give a kind of social status to and cultural status to this genre in particular, and then the consequences of that for the use, the production, and the mobilization of these ink paintings in the lives of scholars and painters in terms of their relationship. So it's a fascinating story. And in the course of the conversation, you're going to hear Ping talk about the ways that she thinks that the story makes particularly important historiographical contributions. So I'm really excited about this interview, in part because of that, as you really are going to have a sense of not just what's happening in the book, but the moments of the book that reach out and speak to the larger field in particularly resonant ways. It's a beautiful book. It's a book that's beautiful not just because of the images and the ways the images form an integral part of the argument, but also because of the ways that it narrates this very intimate relationship among paintings and images and poems and the men who produce them and the women as well. Keep an ear out for the importance of women and empresses in particular to this story. It's a really fascinating part of what's going on here. Okay, well, I'll leave you to the interview. I'll leave it at that. But thank you so much for listening. Thanks for supporting the channel, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Feng Ping about the new book, The Efficacious Landscape. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Ping, and thanks very, very much for being with me today. It's a beautiful book.
Thank you, Carla.
Yeah, we're psyched to talk with you about it. So let's start, as is kind of traditional for the channel, by talking a little bit about how you came to the field. Why art history? Why Chinese art history? And why Northern Song art history in particular?
Actually, I was just talking with somebody who writes about art for Seattle Magazine. That, in fact, I came to art history as a matter of somewhat of an accident, since, you know, I grew up in a traditional Chinese family, so their expectations of me were rather different. And we, growing up, I grew up in Malaysia and Singapore. Art history isn't something that is a normal path, that is really not very well known at all. So actually, I was working on computer science and engineering and all those traditional subjects, and I happened to walk into the wrong room and sat down in an art history class, which truly, as I was saying to this reporter, it was a love story. When I saw what was going on in that class, that was it for me. So immediately, I decided that that's what I wanted to do. So that's how I came to art history. And it was happened to be a Chinese art history class, a course. And the professor who was teaching it, Professor Maggie Bickford, remains to this day a close mentor of mine. And we happened to end up in the same time period that she also worked on the song. So now we have a lot to talk about.
So the book itself takes us into the ink landscape painting of the Northern Song in particular. So what brought you to focus on that particular form?
Well, it's actually another sort of sideways path, you might say. In graduate school, we take a number of courses. I am a student of Professor Wen Huang of Princeton, and he teaches a number of different classes. When he was teaching at Princeton, now he's right now retired. And one of the classes that he taught was in the on the tradition of painting. And of early painting. So in early painting, there are, a number of big names. And oftentimes he would want his students to approach the biggest possible topic and rather with the idea of great ambition. So for that class that I was taking with him, he said to me, "Du wo xi." That was all he said. That was all of the instructions that he gave me to do guo xi. So I went and did guo xi. I went about this by finding everything I could look at and to read, all the poetry, all the original contemporaneous poetry, and also all of the secondary writings on guo xi, and of which there was a lot. And I tried to cover every single base that I could. So to master the topic, in other words, was this idea. And it happened that I was very lucky, and I found something new, or rather I made a new observation, which actually is really perhaps the most important contribution that I've made to the field so far. At least it's something that people know me for, and which is really the basis for undertaking this book. So that's how that happened. I can talk more about that.
What was this new observation? Do you want to give us a sneak peek, and then we'll sort of have that in our mind for when we get to the chapter?
Sure. I was reading, as I was telling you, a group of poetry. So there are many sort of collected works, in this case, every single poem that's ever been written about guo xi. So this is, as you might imagine, is quite a lot. But I was reading a set which was written by Su Shi and his colleagues, Huan Tingjian and some others. And as you probably know, poetry in Shi form sometimes is about answering poetry. So they come in series, they come in groups. So I was reading these. They are known. So it's not that no one has ever read them. But I did make this observation that these poems were talking about a painting that was very familiar to me. I had actually seen this painting in reproductions because I had been gathering all of the guo xi that I could find, of which, there are a group of closer attributions, real authentic works, closer attributions, and then many, many, many more in the style of Li Cheng and Guo Xi, that is, Li Cheng being Guo Xi's master. So I made this connection between this painting I had in my head that I've seen before and this group of poetry. And then it so happened that for that seminar that I was taking with Professor Fong, we took a field trip to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is the repository for this painting that I had seen in reproduction. And when I saw the painting, I nearly keeled over because I knew that this painting was the painting that was being discussed in the poetry. So that was my initial excitement, and cost me many days of sleep because I was so excited. It was amazing. It was completely revelatory. So I Of course, it took many years after that to actually figure out exactly what it was I should be excited about. But there was a moment where there was this great energy. When I went to this to the Met to see this painting, I additionally made some observations about this painting, which no one else has made before, which is that the painting is not just a sort of a generic theme, but there was a very specific rhetorical message that has been conveyed, that this painting was, everything in this painting had a system, that everything came in pairs, and nobody had observed that before. So I went about to try and figure out what was going on in the painting and what was going on in these poem sets around Sushi and his circle, and what were the similarities and what were the differences. Because I had to prove to myself that my initial reaction was, in fact, had some basis to it. So I was trying to figure out, you know, if you read a painting, or rather you receive a painting, you're looking at a painting from the point of view as a poet, you obviously don't have to describe it exactly. I mean, that is not your job as a poet. So there ought to be differences in some ways. But then whether we're able to also tease out some connections between the two, and how can we go about doing that. In fact, I had a lot of help. Mm-hmm. I wrote it up as a talk, and then later on there were some scholars in residence at the Institute of Advanced Studies who were there for the year, and everybody, you know, took a stab at my early paper on this topic. And really, you know, they were very experienced scholars like Charles Hartman, Patricia Ibri, all gave me very good advice as to how to approach, you know, this methodologically speaking. And that was published actually as a standalone article, but it reappears in this book as really an anchor point in part two, and this is chapter four.
So let me situate this for listeners. Okay, so listeners, you've been hearing this term guashi. You've been hearing about this painting, and this is Old Trees Level Distance, right?
That's right.
At the Metropolitan Museum of Art, in chapter four. So let's take a step back and figure out how to get there, right? Who is Guashi?
Yeah.
Why is this important? So mm-hmm. One of the really fascinating things about the book, and we'll talk about this in particular moments as we work through the chapters, precisely speaks to something that you've already been mentioning as, you know, something that brought you into the project in particular, and that is the ways that paintings and poems and texts of various sorts and essays and are all read together as part of the archive of the book. And so there are a lot of different kinds of sources and ways of reading and ways of putting these different sorts of texts, visual texts, verse texts, prose texts into conversation. And so one of the really exciting things about the book, I think, and you know, we'll talk about this at particular mm-hmm. moments, is the way that you are creating this conversation for us among these different kinds of objects and kinds of formats mm-hmm. and sources. So that comes mm-hmm. up, right? Like just right from the very beginning.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So for listeners who don't know anything about the Song Dynasty, I'm just going to take a moment to set the stage here, right? A couple moments. So ink landscape painting was distinctive to the Song Dynasty, and you tell us this in the introduction. The Northern Song period was a really special time for ink landscape paintings. Now, by the 10th century, this kind of painting had emerged as what you call here a scholar's category, whose values were especially worthy of support in critical scholarly discourse. Now, the mm-hmm. book is going to look very carefully at the imperial establishment's efforts to, again, as you put it here, cultivate the genre of ink landscape painting and its iconography as a dynastic project. Okay, so that's mm-hmm. one of the big arguments of the book. Now, Guashi is a really key figure here for many reasons. He's often most well known as Shenzong's favorite painter. He lived in the 11th century, And his most famous surviving work is something called Early Spring. We meet that in the introduction. We're going to come back to it later. Now, the book, given this context, one of the things that the book is going to do is kind of show us, but also complicate a way of interpreting these ink landscape paintings as representations of imperial power. But also, we're going to see that these landscape paintings by the end of the story can also be very kind of intimate objects and records you call them a kind of social currency, and they're records of very intimate relationships and exchanges as much as they speak to and speak for these larger imperial political phenomena.
Okay. Yes, thank you for that summary.
Okay, great. So now we can really get into it. So there's two parts of the book. The chapters in the first part of the book collectively argue that the imperial establishment, again, as you put it, embraced the ink landscape as a distinctive cultural medium in the Song. And we're going to see a few chapters here that look at how that's happening. All right, chapter one. Chapter one brings us into the space of the Song imperial city and its political connotations. Now, this is a super fascinating chapter, at least for me, but all of them are fascinating for me. So in this chapter, you describe the importance not just of buildings themselves and the kind of spatial arrangement of building, but of their decoration. The decoration of buildings was really sensitive to political conditions and political interests, and ink landscape paintings became deeply associated with civil power in this period. Okay, so you take us into a space that was really important for this, and this is the Hanlin Institute. So I'm going to hit the ball back to you at this point. Why is the Hanlin Institute so important in terms of the decoration of building and so important for this particular moment of the study?
For those who may or may not be familiar with the Hanlin Institute, I think perhaps people are more familiar with Hanlin Institute than with the decoration in it.
Sure.
But of course, these are the most erudite, and traditionally from the Tang Dynasty onwards, when it was first founded, the most erudite of the scholars who work in there, who are associated with the academicians. Of course, as far as the textual record is concerned, it is strongly biased towards those who write, and those who write are the academicians themselves. So they really, they tell the only story that we have left to us of this kind of, I would say, consumption of imagery within imperial spaces. So they are on one hand very close to the imperial establishments, the emperor, because they're physically close, but they are, in the Song Dynasty at least, they're also officers, rather officer bureaucrats, literati who are officer bureaucrats. So they have this kind this role of being, on one hand, members of government, but on the other hand, intimate courtiers of the emperor. So there is this traditional versus quote unquote modern Song position of these academicians. So this is one of the reasons why it's fascinating, not just because the records exist for this group of people, but in the space in imperial city, but also because the academicians themselves were interstices. They worked within the intimate space of the emperor, and yet they were members of the outer court of government. So that's one of the reasons.
Now, in the 10th century, landscape was introduced into the main hall of the Hanlin Institute. Why is that such a big deal?
Yeah, very good question. So tradition, of course, is very important when it comes to sort of what is inner city culture. So certain practices that are based in the Tang, when you perpetuate those practices, this is something about calling on the classicistic authority. So in that sense, to refer to the past is a very important practice. So if the Hanlin Institute is decorated in a certain way to revive those kinds of topics and subjects and iconography, it is not just reviving it for reviving sake, but it is reviving a certain past, so a classicistic past. So Hanlin Institute was always had a long history of being decorated in a certain way since the Tang Dynasty. So to change the subject is a very strong act, and it has to have a powerful support from all sides. So that's something which I identify as an important moment in its history. And in fact, the people who write about it also identify it as a change and an important moment. So this is one of the reasons why I think it's possible to be relatively sensitive to what are the taboos. So dragon paintings are not necessarily a taboo, but it is a tricky subject matter to have because it's an imperial subject matter. And if you want to put it in the Hanlin Institute, it's tricky. So there is a story where the picture of dragons had to be obliterated because the emperor was coming, and that was kind of pushing at the boundary of what was acceptable. So this for this reason, I think that it's possible to interpret with sensitivity the things that were allowed and the things that were not allowed, and when changes happen or when references to the past are made.
Right. So the presence of paintings on display, as you tell us in this chapter, what publicly indicated the prestige of an institution. So this was actually a really important statement that there were paintings on display at all. And you take us into the process in which landscape paintings in particular get set up in the Jade Hall, right? And you introduce us to Dongyu's ocean wave paintings and Juran's paintings and a painting by Yan Su. And we meet a lot of individual works here that are just really fascinating for this story. But by the end of it, right, by the end of this chapter, we come back to Guoxi. Now, you bring us into the display of large-scale landscape screens in the offices of the city's central government. These were commissioned by and from Guoxi. Now, these screens are important not just in terms of how we understand, you know, paintings, but they're important to how we understand the history of politics and government here in a really interesting way. The screens, as you argue here, are meant to represent, in your words, the new direction of Shenzong's restructured government. They were monuments of Shenzong's political reform. How were these landscape screens monuments of political reform?
The reason why this chapter, I think, is important is because it shows, it allows us through this one place, the Hanlin Institute, at the early beginnings of how landscape culture took hold, to the time when it reaches its first, its real fruition in some ways. So in fact, it tells us about why Guoxi was so important. So it allows us the full span of theory, basically almost the entire Northern Song. The importance, I think, of Guoxi is because he is able to really, or rather he's called on and he is able to execute these works at the same time and to celebrate Shenzhong's changes, an activist monarchy that had never been seen before. So this was very, very unusual for a sovereign to take up this much change under himself. And both types of both periods of Shenzhong's reforms, including his chief minister's Wang Anshi's new policies, and also after that, the time after he broke Shenzhong and broke away from Wang Anshi's ideas and embarked on his own. So at both times, Guoxi's landscapes were able to, I would say, effectuate that change was happening in government. So he is called on to not just decorate, that is, not just to adorn new halls, but to adorn it by reflecting hierarchy, that is to say, to relate it to the ranks of whoever was sitting in those offices. So this is the so through the Hanlin Institute, we can see that while paintings in general, landscape paintings in particular, were always sort of sumptuary gifts, that is, you know, not everybody got to have paintings, that you had to be special in order to have permission to have painting in within the imperial space. But by the time Guo Xi comes around, his paintings are allocated by ways of a government hierarchy. That is, if you had a certain rank, you could have a certain type of painting by Guo Xi, versus if you had a lower rank, then you can have something else. So this kind of hierarchic deployment, I think, is something which is related to the sort of a almost a direct idea of this governmental restructuring, or this new state ideology that Shen Zhong was trying to present. So it is, in fact, it's possible to. I mean, I began this project as trying to identify in what areas paintings existed, architecturally speaking, being architectonic elements. But in the end, it was possible to tell the story of this great difference in the way that landscaping was consumed in the Hanlin Institute.
So not only is the placement and access to these paintings politically important and interesting, but also the content of these paintings is a kind of political statement as well. And the next chapter takes us into a really fascinating way of reading paintings and scrolls as political documents, right? And it's super fascinating. So chapter 2 and 3, the next chapters in part 1, help us understand, as you put it here, the authority of painting and painters at court. And the second chapter looks very carefully at the context of state sacrifice. This is a chapter on ritual and politics and its manifestations in some really interesting and important paintings. Now, this chapter considers how works by two artists, our Guo Xi that we've been talking about, and also Li Gonglin, engaged with and made painterly contributions to. So this is an important claim, right? They're making contributions through painting to political debates over state ritual. So political debate, in other words, is also taking place in the form of paintings. So this is actually a really important way of helping us understand a way to read sources, right? To read paintings as part of a political debate. Now, you talk about some of the most important ways here that Shenzong's political reforms were manifesting in changes to and debates over state rituals. And these had to do broadly with two major issues, debates about honoring deified ancestors and debates over ending the joint sacrifice to heaven and earth. So what I'm going to do is not talk too much about that in detail, but instead go right to the paintings as a way to talk about what these issues were. So let's go right to them. You talk about, again, paintings by these two artists. Let's first look at Guo Xi. And you start us off here with Early Spring, even though we'd look at some other ones as well. Can you bring us into Early Spring or Guo Xi's work as a political commentary on ritual? How do we read this, and what's in there that helps us understand his political stance and his depiction of ritual as it's related to it?
Well, you know, Carla, first I want to emphasize that, you know, I am an art historian, and one of the things that I wanted to do in this book was really to highlight, to anchor each and every chapter in my book around a group of objects. And so this chapter really is centered around, it is, I am the most proud of all the chapters. I mean, I'm proud of all this whole book, but of all the chapters, I feel that this is the one which really has something special to it. And one of the things which I am most proud of is that this is a very unusual pairing or comparison. That is, nobody compares a landscape painter and a figure painter. Mm-hmm. Nobody does this. So I wanted to find a way to discuss these two painters. Very important. Everyone knows who Guo Xie is. Everyone knows who Li Gonglin is. But to discuss them together and to find, in some ways, the areas in which they are in fact a little bit more similar than we ever imagined, or because they are two people of very, very different status, one being just a court painter, the other, he's an important court painter, he's just a court painter, whereas Li Gonglin has a very different status as a highly educated, but very well-respected scholar and a literati. So even given that, so this chapter attempts to juxtapose them together and to look for resonances. So that's just to practice. The other, I think, aspect of this that I think many readers will go directly to, I presented some of this material, was very well received. It was rather controversial, and not certainly not everyone accepted my findings, but I embarked on this chapter because I wanted to see where it would take me, given that Guo Xie's Early Spring is important not just as a great artistic work, but that it is both signed and dated, and it is one of the earliest signed paintings by an artist himself, and we know exactly about the date. So it's a 1072. Given that it is 1072, it becomes possible to then look in the textual records exactly around that time to see what else is going on. And it is very commonly proposed, stated that Early Spring is a painting that has great spirituality, because it depicts a change of this particular moment in the changing of the seasons, of new growth and transformation. So it can be have a number of different meanings, including basically very very vernacular ones, such as Happy New Year, right? This mm-hmm. is the transition, or sort of the picture of a Taoist nature, of Taoist meaning of transformation. But there's also this other aspect which I prefer to focus on, which is that it has a date and it can be related in some ways to, it's possible to relate it more directly to a ritual events of its time. So given that I know a little bit about Guo Xie and his background, I know my dissertation backing me up on all of the works that can be associated to a time period, I discovered that Early Spring was, in fact, a very interesting moment. It was 5 years. He was a long-established painter, but he entered court relatively late in his years. And this was Early Spring was only 5 years into his court career. So even though he was a well-established painter, this painting was clearly something that was designed to be a showcase of himself. It was not a collaboration. It was a showcase of his skills. Why this work? Well, it's possible, as I said, from my list of more or less same time period or same or works that had similar purposes, in my opinion. Early Spring is not a one-off. There's a couple of others which we can also associate to his ability to respond to things that were going on at that time. So that's another reason to find more political content in Early Spring. Mm-hmm. Then one really interesting piece of evidence came to my attention. It was actually an article which I had photocopied many, many years ago as a grad student. In fact, it was so long ago that the paper had literally turned yellow. And I had only now just gotten around to reading this article. It was an article by a historian of religion, and so he worked, his area of study is this time period. And as I read it, I realized that he was talking about some of the things which I was familiar and was trying to understand. And so that his article had great resonance, actually, with the two paintings that I was reading about. So my feeling was that early spring can be related to the changes at the Round Mound, which is the most important of sacrificial sites of the Song aristocracy, which is a place of triennial sacrifices. It's at the southern suburb of Kaifeng or Imperial City. And once every 3 years. So it so happens that I was trying at first to relate early spring to one of these sacrifices, and wasn't happy until I started reading some of the more specific changes. So, in fact, the date of 1072 doesn't match identically with the very first sacrifice to this newly promoted ancestor, the progenitor ancestor Shi Zhu. But it does commemorate, I think, the moment that Shi Zhu was promoted by Wang Anshi, which is in 1072. So the first sacrifice was actually occurred in 1073, but the time that this ancestor was promoted was 1072, the same time as Guo Xi's early spring. So that is in my estimation, probably as close as we're going to get. But it does represent a new claim for this painting, one of our hallmark works of the Northern Song, and also of landscape painting. So I cannot stress more how important this painting is.
So we could easily speak for another hour, right, just about the rest of this chapter. I want to move on, but I want to just also mention for listeners, one of the really interesting things that's happening here is that the really wonderful account of the importance of this painting in this context that you've just described for us, and that's written and depicted very beautifully in the chapter as well, is juxtaposed with what's happening in the work of Li Gonglin, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this has to do with, how do you read the way this work is depicting things like spirit tablets, and sort of how do we look at this kind of imagery in this larger context and be able to tease out, as you did here, the very not only the presence of a political statement about or reading of the sort of ritual transformation and reform, but also a particular political position on the ritual reform. So it's not just let's read this these scrolls and paintings as political documents that are relevant for understanding the larger context. It's let's read these against each other to be able to tease out particular political positions as they mm-hmm. are manifest visually. And so it's a really, really interesting way of reading and of helping us to read these particular images. And it's a really wonderful chapter. So I'll just leave it. Thank you. So I'll leave it there, but I just want to mark that for listeners. There's a whole lot more we can talk about in that chapter, and I hope listeners will go and read it and use it and model it, actually. It really helps us, it gives us a new way to read and to see, and that's, in my opinion, what a lot of the best work right now does, right?
So the
So the third chapter takes us into kind of further into this context, and it looks at the importance of the notion of lineage in ink landscape painting. Now, you talk here about the reason why lineage is so important here, but let's look at that in the context of the particular case that you give us. Now, chapter mm-hmm. 3 looks at a style of painting known as the Li Cheng style. The chapter mm-hmm. argues that the court is actually making an effort to, as you put it, consolidate its command over an important Song artistic legacy by preserving, by transmitting, and by documenting Li Cheng style landscapes, and by imagining Li Cheng as the founding scholar painter of the imperial landscape style of the age. This is the creation of and the consolidation of this lineage and this particular figure as this lineage. Okay, so I'm just going to ask you to talk about this. How and why did this style become important to sort of imperial taste? And for you, what's most important for us to understand about the contribution that this chapter is making?
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, I think that this chapter perhaps has very broad significance for the study of Chinese painting because it deals with the issue of style. And I'm certainly not the first person to deal with questions of style. But I wanted to highlight how it is actually, I think it's possible to talk about style in a very different way in the sense of that it is not just a way for us to identify lineages in painting for the purposes of authentication, which is one of the major ways that we use the issue of questions of style. That is, we assume that there are lineages in terms of how painters learn how to paint and how their own identity is related to which master they follow. But this chapter actually approaches it from the point of view of how is style important for groups of people. So in this case, the institutional significance of style. So what is the meaning of when a particular group supports a certain one style over another style? So in this case, I wanted to try and recalibrate our ways of approaching this question of lineage. So in this case, the most often stated in the first line of any description of Guo Xi is that he was his master was Li Cheng. So this question of Li Guo, or the joining of their last names, is becomes in its own right a painting style in later times. I think from the Yuan dynasty all the way up to the present, actually. So why Li Guo? So I wanted to understand this because I also noticed that in the textual record, Guo Xi was certainly not the only follower of Li Guo. So it occurred to me that there was a particular reason that Li Guo became important and not anybody else who was a follower of Li Cheng. And so this took me to Li Cheng, who is perhaps the one of the big names of landscape painting, of which we know so little about, because we have, unlike Guo Xi, we have no work which all of us agree on to be by his hand. So to a certain extent, our picture of Li Cheng is rather a little bit more distant to us than is Guo Xi. So as a 10th century master.
And in fact, just to jump in, one of the really mm-hmm. wonderful moments in the chapter is that you're quoting Mi Fu saying, "I want to argue for the non-existence of Li Cheng." Right?
That's right.
So it's just a really fascinating mm-hmm. problem. Anyway, mm-hmm. go on. I'm sorry.
So yes, even in Guo Xi's time, when Mi Fu was active, they were contemporaries, that Li Cheng already has disappeared from the view. So they were, there was already no longer a very clear idea who Li Cheng was. So basically, Li Cheng could be anything that his supporters wanted him to be. So there's questions of authenticity and was already in play at this time. So I in reading all of the source, there have been many scholars who worked on Li Cheng and all of the texts that talk about Li Cheng. And I tried to sort of tease out what roles Li Cheng played. And by doing so, it actually highlighted to me some very important ideas and sources which I had previously not paid attention to, which is that who was Li Cheng's greatest supporters at court? Who was Li Cheng's greatest supporters at court were actually the empresses, not the emperor himself, but these various very important empresses who also served as a regent, one of them. So that, to my opinion, was no coincidence. In fact, it is Zhu Nihu's retelling that one of the stories survives as to how Li Cheng's great-granddaughter was called to court to authenticate works that were in the collection. And those works were presented by the Empress Dowager to her grandson, Shen Zhou. So to highlight that this process of finding real Li Cheng was actually pushed forward by the empresses, by the female monarchy. And that, in fact, it's quite possible that it is through their power and their support in their hand that landscape painting came to the fore in the imperial city. That is something which is a very that we have not paid attention to before, an entirely new observation.
So that's really awesome. And there are actually several moments in the book where you're pointing us to the importance of support and patronage by empresses specifically. Mm-hmm. I just want to highlight that and like make a verbal highlighter marked in big yellow color over that. It's a really interesting part of the story. The chapter, to close out part one, the chapter argues that the court's doing a few different kinds of things, right, at least in order to cultivate and create this particular mm-hmm. lineage and this particular style, right? They create mm-hmm. a collection that's focused around this idea of authenticity, as you've described it. They invested in Guo Xi as a painter who they decided was the best representation of the Li style, and they wrote a history of Li Cheng that explained, that explained his achievements as appropriate for the court. So there's all kinds of fascinating things happening in that chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It is sorry. I simply wanted to add that it is a way to reuse all our great sources, which surviving paintings, which are in, we can tell with our own eyes, are Li Cheng paintings, but we cannot say are Li Cheng, which is actually a negative way of looking at it, and instead turn it on its end and to use those to say, well, the court perhaps commissioned these as copies of Li Cheng style. Why would a court want to do that except to promote a particular way of painting as its most as the most prominent of court products? So, in fact, it creates a very new window into these paintings as very important sources rather than as not so great attributions. So.
That's right. Okay, so there's so much going on in part one that we haven't had a chance mm-hmm. to talk to, but there's also part two. So let's get
sure.
to. Okay, so the chapters in part two take us into the significance and the outcomes of these transformations that we've been talking about in part one. So the court is mm-hmm. investing in the ink landscape as a cultural medium. What are some of the important outcomes of this? Now, the medium is, as a result, as you put it here, acquiring new social dimensions. In the final decades of the 11th century, these intimate scenes appeared, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And also, intimate landscape paintings become socially acceptable outlets of expression And they're used as a kind of mode of exchange, a medium of exchange and private communication among scholars. Now, there is easily like probably an hour or two of stuff that we can talk about here. So we're just going to skim the surface, but let's at least peek in and see some of the cool stuff that's happening. Chapter 4 is looking at these intimate scenes painted by Guaxi. And at the beginning of our conversation, you've already talked a little bit about this hand scroll, Old Trees, Level Distance in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And you've talked a little bit about how important and surprising and exciting this is. Now, you describe this as the only surviving work. So I just want to mark this because this is a really strong and very important claim. You describe this as the only surviving work in which one might find a trace of the individual and gain insight into his person, his relationships, and his values. So bring us into this painting. How do we read this painting as a way to give us access to the individual? What's important for you for us to understand about what's in this painting and the consequences of what's in this painting?
Yes, that is a good question. Because art historians always worry about making such claims that there is any something of the artist himself that he's placing inside his painting that we can actually tease out as secondary viewers. Well, in this case, it is, in fact, the observation that my observation that this painting couldn't be more unlike Guaxi's other painting that we talked about earlier, that is Early Spring. And it is because it is so different that it pushed me to try and understand why. So as the great court painter, Shen Zhong's favorite court painter, and the great representation of the Li Cheng dynastic style, Zong style of landscape, it would appear very, very strange for him to paint these small works for private purposes. But that was what I set out to show. And it was possible to do this because of the set of poetry that Su Shi wrote, which actually, again, received Guaxi's paintings in ways which were very unexpected. That is to say, they saw Guaxi's little, these small paintings by Guaxi and wrote very movingly about their discomfort and their dissent, their disagreement with what was going on in their political life. Mm-hmm. So this reception of Guaxi's painting is in fact almost ironic, given that Guaxi was Shen Zhong's favorite painter. In fact, the disagreement with Shen Zhong through Guaxi's paintings there is some irony in that. I did some biographical work on Guaxi. We know actually surprisingly little about him, even though of any of the painters from the Northern Song we know the most, because there survived texts that are attributed to him and as were certainly edited by his son. So Guaxi still remains an enigmatic figure, but on the other hand, I have been able to tie him to a very prominent Fan family, a Sichuanese clan. So he wasn't just anyone. He wasn't just a illiterate court painter. He was he had a very powerful relations, number one. And number two, it would seem that he also was acquainted with several prominent statesman, namely Fu Bi, who was a former grand counselor, and also Wen Yuanbo, another former grand counselor. So he was incredibly well connected. He was also the same age as them. So given that and some other sort of issues where all of them were in semi-exile in the second capital, Luoyang, together, I felt that it was possible to propose a sort of a setting in which this kind of work might have been created for. So this, number one, on the one hand, social relationships a private setting in which such a painting might have found resonance. So this chapter, therefore, is, as I said earlier, is one which I'm primarily known for. This is the original finding. The reading of Su Shi's and Huang Tingjie's and Su Che's poetry and their increasingly loud protestation that they lodged as they were looking at Guo Xi's very desolate imagery. And secondly, Guo Xi's biography itself, which I think we can propose, I think, that it's the context against which to interpret the existence of these paintings.
That's right. And there's so much more that we could talk about, right, in terms of this chapter. I mean, the poetry itself, like, we won't have time to talk about the details, but there's a whole long, really wonderful accounting of these poetic exchanges in the chapter. So listeners who are particularly interested in that, there's a lot of attention to that in this chapter, and it's fascinating. And it's one of the really exciting ways that the book is bringing together poetry, literature, critical reading of those kinds of sources with critical mm-hmm. reading of images and paintings. And in fact, one of the things that you propose in this chapter, and we don't have to talk a whole lot about it, but it's just it's a way of modeling how this juxtaposition can help actually read the paintings. You propose that it's possible at least to interpret the hand scroll as a picture of this statesman Wen Yanbo at leisure, right? So once mm-hmm. we understand the biography, and once we understand these relationships, it actually helps us see, at least potentially, right, the painting in a new way. So there's a whole other chapter, right, chapter 5, that really kind of takes these insights and extends them into a conversation about the ways that more and more painters, like from a bunch of social classes, aristocrats, court officials, professional painters, begin to work in this more intimate mode, as you call it, of landscape painting. And they create these intimate scenes, as you describe them here. So these are not works that are intended for public display, but instead they're works that are intended or that are associated with particular kinds of social occasions, right? Making acquaintance with someone, saying farewell to someone. And they become a kind of social currency, a personal communication among friends and acquaintances. Now, there's a ton that we could talk about in here. You give us, for example, a reading of some of the imagery in these paintings that can help us understand the larger conversations that they were part of. And some of this imagery is strikingly associated with a larger theme that permeates these two chapters, and that is the theme of exile. So you've mm-hmm. already talked a little bit about this, but can you maybe just very briefly talk a little bit about the ways that these particular intimate painted scenes are bound up in, are reflecting, are imaging concerns with exile?
Mm-hmm. So this chapter really is a discovery of paintings that were cohorts of the old feet level difference by Guo Xi. So the kind to again emphasize that this works by Guo Xi, these intimate works by Guo Xi, were not one of, even though he may have been one of the first people to do it, but that in fact there was a larger push towards this other category of painting, which function in a very different way than the grand display paintings. And in that sense, the gift culture was a very important part of it, that they became currency, a literal currency of gift and exchange, that one literati oftentimes exchanged poetry, but suddenly it became possible to also exchange paintings amongst each other as part of that, similar part of that process. That was, of course, the context, and the subjects were also somewhat related to the poetic subjects. First of all, one of the main purposes was during this was something that Li Gonglin was the progenitor of. He started this idea that one could give a painting as opposed to a poem as a farewell gift. So, of course, farewell becomes a very important subject matter for this kind of what I call intimate painting. Farewell is, of course, just the other side of the coin to exile. That is this on a sliding scale. You say goodbye to somebody. Why do you say goodbye to somebody? One can play in very different ways. That is because they're leaving to take up a new government office, or because they're leaving because they're being exiled. So this kind of imagery, a pictorial imagery, can in fact read many different ways. And there are paintings which survive that fall on both ends of the spectrum. I wanted to tell this after the chapter on Old Tree Double Distance, to try and open up the conversation to discuss the broader context for the existence of these small privately produced paintings.
Great. Now, there's a whole lot more going on in that chapter, right? And there's a whole conclusion mm-hmm. on top of this that does lots of stuff to wrap up the book and to mm-hmm. also point us to the important issue of Guoxi's legacy under Huizong. Which is also right an important issue. Do you want to speak to that last issue briefly, or would you rather?
Oh, sure.
As a kind of mystery for. Okay.
Oh no, I'm very proud of this.
Okay.
this conclusion, because it does, of course, come together after many years of study, and the story of Guoxi has always ended on a melancholic tone, because this is a story from riches to rags. That
literally,
is Guoxi,
right? literally.
Literally to rags, that Guoxi's large public works, that Deng Zhong tells us that his paintings became discarded and started the mounters in the bureaus started using it to wipe up the table.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is how to interpret this, given all that we know of Guoxi's importance under Huizong's father, Shen Zhong. Why would Shen Zhong allow this to happen? And sometimes the story is told that, in fact, it is because Huizong's attention had turned to a very different viewpoint, that his taste was not of the Li Cheng Guoxi style. But in my opinion, this is very difficult to support that point of view, that given all that we know, that perhaps this idea that the changing taste of the sovereign can result in this kind of turning important paintings to rags, that it actually reflects too much of the 20th century ideas of preservation and conservation that we must conserve only. But I feel that it is possible to take a different spin on it. That Huizong indeed had a more art historical bent, but he was perhaps looking to only preserve his Guoxi's and his father's favorite painter's legacy in certain areas, but not that everything should be preserved. So I think that the story feels better, that we should not have this as an incongruous picture that he decided to his new focus on ancient paintings resulted in this deterioration of Guoxi's painting. It was not actually a loss of favor, but it was actually because Guizhong was trying to evaluate and to incorporate Guoxi's contribution into the larger picture of Song dynastic legacy.
So there is a ton of stuff that we didn't have a chance to talk about, right? There's a lot of analysis and lots of wonderful works in all of these chapters. But now that we're at the conclusion of the conversation, mm-hmm. is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Mm, yes. Perhaps to emphasize that It may seem that this book is a monograph on Guo Xi, but actually to say that it's a very strong focus on this painter Guo Xi, but on the other hand, it attempts to utilize these two aspects of Guo Xi to tell a big picture of Song painting history, to attempt to to try and tell the story with a different balance. That is to say, it is a story of the literati versus court painters, but it is a story of court painting in general, of people at court. That includes court painters and literati painters. So that is perhaps one of the larger purposes in this book.
And now that the book is out, what's next for you? What are you working on now, and what are you inspired by?
Yeah, well, as you know, I've decided to try my hand at being a curator. So I'm at present trying to broaden my horizons and to attempt to learn about things that have nothing to do with the Song court and to perhaps even to or organize to try and to gain some expertise in contemporary art. But I actually still have a book project that has been in the works for a while now. So I've been working on what I think I broadly construe as spatial issues that can be defined by the institutional position of artists at the academy system. So primarily the painting academy, but also more broadly speaking, these expert artists, including calligraphers, painters, doctors, astronomers, and so forth, and how they were associated with the Song court. More specifically, I'm focusing on a write-up on another court painter, actually Guo Xi's predecessor, Huang Quan, the very first person who was associated with the Song Painting Academy, and to try and find connections between the way that Huang Quan received his position and titles when he was an artist in Sichuan, and after he arrived as a political holdover at the Song court after the Sichuanese kingdom fell to the first Song emperor. So there's still plenty to do. And some of this work is slowly coming into press.
Well, best of luck with that work. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me about The Efficacious Landscape. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you for the opportunity, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.